Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of FarmCon Podcasts. I am Todd Leckler, co-host, along with my good friend Kevin Van Trump in Kansas City. Kevin, how are you doing today, sir?
Doing all right, Todd. Doing all right.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw those updated numbers. I know we'll get into corn, bean, and wheat later, but yeah, I can verify, living out here in the panhandle, that Nebraska's numbers are verifiable. It's tough sledding out here for a lot of folks. But hey, I was going to start today. I wanted to ask you, on these stories you've been writing lately, it's pretty cool stuff, but we touched on it. Everybody's been asking me about this Hanna virus stuff. You ran a story yesterday on it, and just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Is that going to affect you guys' travel? Do you travel enough? I mean, you used to travel a lot. I mean, is that kind of freaky? Or is it a concern? Because I haven't gotten into it. And when I saw the story, I'm like, okay, better start looking into it, see how big of a concern it is. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm not concerned. I mean, okay. I'm not concerned at all, but I mean, I think it's just
the latest news.
I'm not really an adventure explorer type traveler. That's for damn sure.
Not anymore.
I'm not like a billy goat climbing up any mountaintops or anything. So, no, I just think as you push some of that more extreme travel, a lot of younger people, there's a lot of older people too that want to go to places where nobody's really gone before, see things nobody's seen. I think you start pressing that into the Amazon areas and into the Arctic, some of those Arctic, Antarctic areas. That's really what's happened. And there's a chance you could catch something that jumps to from animal to human. And you got people in places that they've never been and diseases that we really haven't really seen make jumps. And it's that. Then also, Todd, the speed at which we can travel now. So
yeah, no doubt.
That's really what the whole story is. I mean, people leave those remote areas and get home so fast, or go then and get on a cruise ship. That's what happened in this case. And then you're on a cruise ship a day or two later before the symptoms actually show up. And next thing, you're exposing all kinds of people to this new, type of human-to-human disease that we haven't seen. And that's what happened. And they were in some colder areas up there on that cruise ship. And so
that's what surprised
a lot
me.
Of the folks. But then they had to stay inside. I mean, you can't be outside. So then when you got, a bunch of people all kind of inside, you're obviously in tighter quarters. And then that couple out of Argentina was doing the bird watching or whatever. They contracted it when they were out there in those areas. And the next thing, they bred it and spread it to the rest of the crew. So, I don't know. Like I said, I think you're going to see that more and more. And I've always said, since COVID, I got to believe you got all these companies now that have all these ways to detect it, and everybody's on high alert for anything possible. So, you got a lot more eyes looking for stuff like that. You got a lot more companies out there now testing or trying to make money off stuff like that. And I think the media is going to go nuts with it. So I think anytime anything like that pops up, oh, my gosh, it's going to be, the headlines are going to scream that it could be the next COVID. But from everything I've read, I mean, it doesn't seem like it spreads anything like COVID spreads or anything like we had seen on that. So, I think it's just where we're going to be moving forward with the ability to detect things quicker, the ability for people to travel further and farther than they ever have quicker, and then you throw in the media wanting to just, pump up and get any headline possible and make it more extreme than it is. I think that's the world we're going to live in moving forward. So
No, I'm not.
I guess if I catch it and I die, I guess that's what happens. But I mean,
no, and I'm not even asking that. I've heard about it, smattering. I mean, I've heard my wife bring it up. She scours stuff, and I was glad you wrote on it because I mean, it's been in the news enough. I mean, it's something that's working. I know we have a lot of people that do some serious travel. I don't know if they're climbing mountains, but they're getting on cruise ships, and so it's good to know that. That's one of the reasons, man, everybody likes it. I love the report, too, because I run across things, even I, who am on the Internet and not helping do some research, don't always see. And you ran that flash food story today. I'm like, man, that's awesome. That's perfect. And with inflation as it is now and cost, I mean, that's probably going to blow up. What did you think about that flash food company?
Yeah, I mean, I could see it having its moments, I guess. It's like whenever you go into a recession, anything that's going to be cheap or help people save money, I think that's going to be the case. Like, they've seen, TJ Maxx, I think, had a nice run, and you've seen some of these other companies that are, dollar cutting or dollar saving. I mean, yeah, I personally don't probably want to go buy the food that's spoiling, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a place for that in the market. It seems like a logistical nightmare to me, but I don't know. I bet it's working, like you said, in all kinds of different things, or, you know, like you said, flowers that are about to go back, you know, you're just blowing them out at some really discounted prices.
Sure. I guess what surprised me, one thing, but, you know, you've taught me a lot to look at business models and just, you know, all the different things in that regard. I'm like, well, I was surprised. You would think there's a million situations and surplus issues, and especially when things can go bad or overabundance, that this could be a problem. I guess I'm surprised there's still apps out there that haven't covered everything, and we're still uncovering new props. So it kind of intrigued me in that regard. I played around a little bit and saw did some different things with AI and read about it. So anyhow, well, listen, let's get in, man. We got a lot to talk about with the WASD numbers from yesterday and planning for engine stuff. So let's just dive in, brother, because I know you had a lot of questions in yesterday's report before the numbers came out, especially with corn and a lot of answers. But so tell us what we got out of it and what it means going forward and what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think you have to start with the wheat market. I mean, the wheat was the most bullish numbers from the USDA. And I didn't just take a moment to go through it. I think and it may be not a big surprise to anyone. A little bit of it, I would say it was somewhat of a surprise to me because I have some hedges. I shouldn't say hedges. I have some spreads on as a spec where I am short July 26 hard red and July 27 hard red against corn and against soft red wheat. So I took an ass kicking on the limit move in the hard red versus the corn. But, you know, there are a lot of reasons that we can get into and how I'm looking at some things. But really, you know, what happened is hard red ending stocks, the USDA came out and they're forecasting them at 515 million bushels versus 804 million bushels last year. And really, it was on the big reduction in harvested acres. Obviously, also the lowering of the yield and the production numbers for hard red. And I think we'd seen that. You know, we talked about that throughout the reports of what you'd seen. You know, the single-digit good to excellent ratings for Nebraska, Colorado. Kansas was double digits, but still dismal. Oklahoma and Texas. So, you know, we kind of knew it going in. I didn't think that the USDA would cut as dramatically as they did on the hard red side, but, you know, it is what it is. I think that's probably the low water mark for where we'll see production come in on that hard red side. But like I said, I don't know that. And to be honest with you, Todd, I didn't make any sales in wheat just because we have these crop tours taking place. We have some this week and a couple in the coming weeks ahead. That could produce some bullish headlines. We also have this upcoming meeting with President Trump and Tsai scheduled for here later this week. And, you know, there's some talk that China could step in and purchase some more wheat into that meeting or at the end of that meeting, whether it be milling wheat or, you know, some type of – I'm banking that they're going to purchase milling wheat. That's why I was positioned soft red over hard red. Even though I knew that we were facing these production problems in hard red, I felt like the hard red had gotten a little ahead of itself and maybe we were going to have some disappointment that China would step in here and buy some soft red and we'd make that pop to the upside and adjust that spread a little bit. Yeah, we don't know. I don't know. I'll see how that plays out. I'm also, like I said, I'm long beef 27 corn, which we're trading above $5. You know, you're up closer to that. Oh, let me give you an exact time. I think we're trading beef 27, just north of 510, so 510, 515 there. And I'm long it against the short, hard red Deese 27. So, you know, yes, there's crazy, it's a crazy spread. I'll just be honest with you. I was wanting to get short a little bit of hard red winter wheat because I thought we'd gotten a little ahead of ourselves, and this is kind of a really, I guess, candy-ass way. But, you know, so I decided to go long some back the back end of the corn market against the back end of the wheat market. And I think, you know, I could face some serious – I'm already facing some pain, but I could face some serious pain, you know, if this continues for a while. So I'm trading super small right now, and I said that to myself when I put the position on. And I'll try and leg into maybe a little bit more. But I think at the end of the day, you know, fundamentals come back home to roost. I want to believe that the corn market can stay stronger for longer than the wheat market. The wheat market feels like it's somewhat of a weather market, and it's, you know, straight up, straight down, possibly. But with these military headlines and the conflict in the Middle East, there's some logistical concerns. There's other concerns. There's, you know, we tightened up the global balance sheet to some degree. We're seeing some, you know, some pullbacks because of the higher input prices. You're seeing a lot pullback in some of these global planting. So just as we all know that the world has taken over and is able to plant a lot more wheat, so we've kind of become the ancillary supplier, in this situation with these higher input costs and the U.S. being somewhat insulated, a little bit insulated, being the leading producer of crude in the world, we're less impacted, Todd, by what's happening with some of the conflict in the Middle East as far as the higher input prices. So what I'm trying to get at is, you could see, and the USDA is kind of forecasting it, that we're going to see a pretty decent pullback in global wheat acres. And, you know, that's kind of the worrisome area, I guess, sitting here in my position where I'm long corn versus short wheat on the back end. Yes, technically you could see a bigger cut in the wheat production side of things globally than you will on the corn side. So I may be, you know, married to this loser for quite some time. Now, I'm not going to do nuts here. I'm already taking it on the chin, so we'll just kind of see how things play out. I didn't make any additional sales in anything, corn, beans, or wheat, just because, you know, we got this meeting with Trump and Xi coming up. We've got a little bit more, obviously, more weather ahead. I'm just going to take a patient day by day here. I like the position we were in coming into it, where we've been and where we're at on a marketing perspective. So, you know, I think the wheat is, boy, we were targeting this window of opportunity. We've got more. It came to fruition as I expected, but in a better way than I had thought. I think the military headlines out of the Middle East has added some fuel to the fire to allow the funds to take a more bullish stance and a more bullish position outright in commodities. And that gave us more of a tailwind than I had expected. I thought we were going to see, you know, some bullish USDA numbers a while back, and I'd kind of forecast our window out here to be pricing bushels. We made those sales. I got to just wait here a minute, Todd, before we make any more, especially for folks that, you know, that are out there and you don't know what your production is going to be. I hate to ever see anybody get oversold, and I would never recommend that. So you can always sell up to kind of, you know, where you're comfortable thinking your production might end up. So for some of the folks out by you, Todd, I mean, they can't make any sales, and they're probably not going to make any. You know, they're looking at 2027 crop then. And,
right.
You know, I think it's a great place to start. You got 2027 hard red at what? Above 750, I believe. I think there's some good things here that have come from this this latest round of the USDA numbers. You know, I think you got to be looking at them real close and real hard here, especially in this wheat, and try to make some early sales. You got July 27, next year's soft red wheat, Todd, trading north of 720 now. So, you know, there's some great opportunities to price some bushels if you don't, or uncertain about what you're going to produce this year. I wouldn't feather in any more sales. I would look more to 2027 and maybe price a little bit there, just so, you know, you got a good starting point and a good stake in the ground to start marketing around. So, you know, that's kind of what we're looking at on the wheat front. I already have 20% of 27 price and a floor on 10% that would kick me out at about 750. So we're right about where we want to be. I may feather in another sale. If we can catch some additional tailwinds here and push this market higher, I'll probably make another sale, Todd, for 2027 wheat and get myself to 30% price with an early start, which, boy, you won't hear me complaining. I promise that. And I know there have been a lot of people asking, or at least that I'm talking to as friends and stuff. It's like, you know, how are we going to price in 2027 when we don't even know where our inputs are going to be in 2027, right? And that's a good question. I mean, it's a fair question. But like I said, I go back through history, and I've tested every possible marketing model imaginable. And, you know, there could be a chance that we're caught a bit offside if inputs stay higher for longer and remain crazily elevated. But starting with wheat at +$7 at your first 30-40%, boy, it's really never seemed like a bad thing to me. Or I can't count. It can't be but a couple of times maybe that was ever, possibly a mistake of some sort. But
right.
I think it's a great place to start. You got corn north of $5. You know, I'm not saying you're going to hit any huge home runs because, you know, we may gradually pull back those inputs. It may not just be, you know, just straight up and straight down as far as input price go. That's typically right. They raise the prices on them like crazy, and then they're slow to lower, right? So we probably suspect that's going to be their play. And you know, so, you know, +$5 corn certainly doesn't look as good today as it did back in January, you know, just because of the big jump in diesel and fuel and the inputs. But I think President and I think the people in Washington are super aware of that, and they're going to probably try to do anything and everything in their power to get fuel prices back down and to, try to come up with some type of program that either gets the input cost, the fertilizers and the input costs down, or some type of subsidy that helps, that helps us stomach some of those higher costs. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. I like pricing into the rally. It's just like we're seeing in the beef market, you know, right now there's chatter that, the administration is going to come out and lower the import tariffs that were placed on beef and to try and get the beef prices at the grocery store down, right? Well, shit,
yep.
If that happens, you know what's going to happen to the cattle market price. I mean, prices are going to go down, right? I mean, we're going to have lower cattle prices. And you're sure in the hell not going to encourage any ranchers and cow-calf operators to expand the herd. So that's not a long-term solution. You see what I'm saying? And the market will have a knee-jerk. And that's why I'm just worried that if corn, let's say beans and corn, those things take off and rally more, we're going to hear more food for fuel debates. We're going to hear all kinds of other things come into the picture. And who knows what the government will do or global governments will do and what kind of legislation they'll come out with that could then all of a sudden knock the hell out of our prices of wheat, corn, beans, who knows, and take us back lower. That's what I'm saying. I like shooting when the ducks are in the air. And, you know, it's always the most bullish at the top and always the most bearish at the bottom. And I think you want to be pulling the trigger on rallies just because I think input costs, I think the war headlines will eventually subside, or this conflict is in the Middle East. I think that'll take some of the excitement or some of the winds out of the sails for the bullish fund commodity bulls. I think you'll see energy prices obviously retreat and pull back. And I think with that obviously comes the inputs of being lowered. And, you know, if we get past this U.S.-China summit that the bulls have been leaning on for the past 3 months, 4 months, that it's going to produce this massive wave of U.S. demand. Maybe it does. I don't know. But we'll get past it, and that's what I'm trying to say. You're at peak military right now. You're at peak possibility of Trump trying to pull, you know, some big demand move here, President Trump getting China to buy some U.S., a lot more U.S. supply. And I feel like you're at peak weather worry in the wheat market. So, to me, you know, you're at peak uncertainty in the Middle East, you're at peak uncertainty, you know, here with the Trump-Xi meeting, and you're at peak uncertainty on the weather. You know, typically, once those cards are flipped over and the answers are revealed, the market tends to not see that as being uncertainty anymore, and we tend to not add as much risk premium as that may have been, you know, believed to have been needed. Now, let's say this, Todd, in that same breath, sure, if Iran goes rogue, shit, I don't know what could happen. The stray missiles going everywhere. Okay, we're not at peak Middle East right then, right? Well, okay, Trump and Xi come to some crazy, and Trump, they ink some crazy, that China's going to switch by all kinds of things from us here in the U.S. from an ag perspective. Okay, we're not there. And then maybe weather gets worse. I'm not seeing that in forecast, but maybe it does. Well, in that case, we wouldn't be at peak any of those. So kind of as a marketer or trader, you're asking yourself, are we at a peak where the worst weather is kind of in? Are we at a peak where the most optimism is in for U.S.-China trade? Are we at a peak where we're the most worried about future input cost, meaning the what happens to diesel or what happens to nitrogen prices, anhydrous, things like that. You know, are we at a peak of those fear-wise? And you know, I feel like we are, but I could be dead wrong as well, and this thing just continues to play out. But, I personally think things are going to calm down in the Middle East. I think, like I said, we're going to get some things under control. I think the weather forecast, at least the thing we talked to Gary and some of the other guys about, I think it's going to prove more cooperative than problematic from where we are at the moment. And you know, I think those are a couple of the biggies that we want to look at. So that's kind of where I'm at, Todd, as far as.
Yeah, let me circle back just to clarify a couple of things. Casey, you do believe then if we kind of stay in this, you think there's going to be a regulatory or a subsidy involved? Big picture, that there's going to be something where the government's going to ease the pain on input costs in relationship to trying to price 27 corn or 27 crops, you said. So,
well, I suspect there could be that if. I mean, you know, if prices were to drop back lower and still have these elements.
Right. But
I think I could see something possibly being done to it seems like presidents come in the past and seems to have wanted to take care of rural America and producers and ranchers, and so I don't think he's trying to hurt anyone. I think that's the least thing he's trying to do on that front. So
yeah.
Like I said, I could see them circling around at some point if they stay elevated into new crop, like most people are saying. I think, 70%, 80% of production ag had already had their fertilizer and inputs locked in prior to this conflict in the Middle East. So the media wants to blow it up a massively huge
crop
at the moment because both parties try to take the farmer under their wing and say they're their part, they're their people. And, you know, I got it. And yes, it is a problem that prices are higher. And I'm not saying it isn't a problem. It is a problem. But I don't think it's warranted some of this media attention that we've seen, at least yet. It could. I mean, if prices stay crazy elevated and these diesel prices stay with that and these fertilizers stay up, okay, now you have a story. And maybe that ends up happening. But if that's the case, that's what I'm saying. If it really ends up like that, I do think the administration will try to figure something out to provide some help or some subsidy in some way, shape, or form to try and make sure we stay at the, as a leader in global agriculture. So.
And then the only other thing I want to clarify in case I missed it, I feel like I got your 27 price target for wheat. Did you throw out your next price target for 26 wheat? Did I miss
that? No, I just said maybe. I think you got to be really careful here because we're already 60% priced. And that's
right, we are.
I don't want anyone thinking, don't do what I'm doing because we have locations all across with the U.S. that we're helping people price.
Right.
But in areas like you're at, Todd, Nebraska, I mean, if you were already 50% priced, I don't know how you could sell much more into this, right?
No,
I mean,
you couldn't.
I mean,
you could
be over. And that's what I'm saying. You got to dial that back. So I would be hesitant. For us, we have to play it at least on paper and for everyone that, our crop isn't impacted. So, we're playing it as 60%. And it probably isn't impacted over the whole grand scheme of things. So we're probably not really much impacted. We've got some areas that are going to be a lot better than expected. We're going to have some areas that are a lot worse than expected. So net, probably close to where we'll be. But – Yeah. I think you got to be looking to price a little more. Yeah. I don't have any price targets out there at the moment.
Right.
Just because I pulled them going into this report because I was worried shit like this was going to happen, like we're going to end up limit up.
Right.
And just limit up with the Trump Zai meeting. I mean, I'm counting 10 Mississippi. I think you got to just see a pause here.
Right.
And, which is fine. And I have no issue with that. So like I'm saying we could get an extended bump. Here's what I'm saying. I don't think you're going to see just a massive. Will runaway train to the downside anytime soon with the crop ratings and conditions where they're at, and the USDA number out where it is? I think we got a window here of 2-3 weeks where I think we're going to see somewhat of a little bit of a safety net under the wheat prices, because I think you're going to see these funds that were net short, maybe they got to flip to the net long, and there's a lot of room that they could run this thing on the long side. So I wouldn't, you know, I'm in no hurry to make sale here, especially if you're uncertain about your production. So, you know, that's why I wanted to be in the position we're in going into this, because of this right here. And I like where we're at. I think we just the decision to do nothing is a decision. I think you do nothing here at this point is in regard to a wheat sale. If you haven't made any wheat sales for 2027, now my opinion is I'd be out making a few. I mean, like I said, I'd get 5, 10, 15% estimated, maybe even 20% of your estimated production price. That's where I'm at. But if you're not comfortable doing early sales, you know, maybe some people, you just want to start with 10%. But I'd definitely be getting a line in the water here and something to anchor and trade against or market against as we move forward. You know, the harvest will be coming up here in 2026 crop, but you're right around the corners planning to 2027. So, you know, yeah. I think you take a nibble a little bit at it.
No, don't disagree. Hey, you touched earlier a little bit on the beef market, but you run a great story yesterday on the record beef prices creating demand destruction. Just touch on the highlights of that and how I related with the GLP users, you know, maybe keep us supportive.
Are we done with corn and beans?
I apologize. Did we?
No, I don't care. You go either way.
Well, let's just keep going. Let's just go because you touched on beef, and then we'll go back to bean and corn.
Whatever.
So just touch on the beef, on that beef story and the record beef creating demand destruction potentially.
Well, you've already seen demand destruction. I think from that graphic we ran the other day where you're seeing the chicken demand versus beef, man, I think you've seen that, you know, play out quite a bit over, the last 20, 30 years. But what we're seeing with the GLP-1s is you're seeing people spending more when they go out to eat, but they're spending on higher protein, higher cut, higher premium foods. And so beef's hanging in there. The fear is if you continue to get prices elevated and continue to elevate, you will do long-term damage to the supply side of that market. And I think that's a little bit of the fear, and with beef prices where they're at right now. Like you've even said, it's like, holy hell, you and your wife go out to get a double cheeseburger or something, and I mean, you're breaking the bank, right? I think it's hard to swallow at this from the casual, fast casual, whatever you want to call the chain, the Shake Shack burger, the Whataburger. You go to any of the places. I mean, it's not Sonic. I mean, don't you agree, Todd? I mean, you've seen the same.
I know, but Kevin, we came back Friday night. It was Friday night, granted. Dairy Queen, Sydney, Nebraska, Piper Lake 610. I mean, dude, we wait a half hour for our food. I mean, they were just packed. It's like, I mean, I'm with you. Prices are stupid, but people are. I'm just wondering when the train stops, and we'll get into this in the macro, when the consumer spending train stops. But anyway, I just wanted to touch on that.
I don't know, but I know this. Every phone call I get off anymore with my buddies, I said, man, I remember my grandparents when I'd have to go out to eat with them, or we'd go places. My grandparents, we always had big family reunion. We had, you know, just a huge family. We had all these things, family there. But boy, I'd let sit around at the table and listen to old people talk. I was like, I got off the phone with my buddies the other day, and we were playing poker Friday night, and it was the same thing. All the conversations revolved around politics, who we knew that had died or had gotten into the hospital. And all were bitching about higher prices on eating out in the grocery store. And I said, holy smokes, guys. I mean, listen to us. I mean, we're talking about health problems, politics, and higher costs at the grocery store. And I'm like, we have all definitely gotten old. So, you know, I don't know. But it seems like, Todd, that's topic conversation amongst – if you
hey,
get
– Hey, Kevin, we need to create –
55 and older, that's where you're headed. What?
We need to create a category called 15th tee talk or fourth quarter talk, final 2 minutes or something, because you always like to reference, hey, man, we're on the 15th tee of life here and stuff. And it is funny. But that's, you know, that's the season we're in, and that's why we make sure we talk to a lot of young people. Ain't that right? So,
No, I hear you. So, you know, I think yes. And your question is could you see a longer-term demand destruction of beef? maybe with these higher prices, but then again, maybe not, Todd. As more and more people do these GLP-1s and take all these weight loss, they're needing that higher protein, and there's really no replacement for that higher protein. And maybe the beef's going to hang in there. You know, you've seen the big setbacks in, like, alcohol consumption and things, like, especially with the GLP-1s, people can't drink as much. You know, instead of drinking four drinks, they can drink two, and they're just drunk off their ass to some degree. So it's like, you know, you're seeing a pullback there. You're seeing, you know, weed came in, the marijuana became legal, so that probably impacted a little bit. The kids seem to like to smoke the vapes and stuff more than they like drinking, you know, or like we used to when we were younger. So, you know, you can see it there. But maybe this beef demand probably stays fairly stable with more of the GLP-1s coming on, just because I think you're going to see them cut out those more, like Carter's talk, more of the processed foods, the crappier foods are going to get the cut. And I think beef's going to hang in there. I'm worried about how the government, though, is going to try and lower these beef prices in the store and what that impact that'll have on us cow-calf and ranch operations. So I don't know. That's probably got me more squirreled up than the GLP-1s is what the government might do, thinking they're doing right and good.
Right.
But it ultimately ends up being really bad. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think most of the time the government goes at things with the best of intentions, but when they play out, it's like going into the forest and you think you're saving the spotted owl and you're doing all this, but shit, in the end you end up disrupting the whole apple cart. So, you know, like I said, I think the government tends and tries to do what's best for the people, but in the end, we sometimes by manipulating all that, we end up really screwing some things up. So I just worry. With these beef prices as high as they are, it's attracting a lot of attention, and anything's probably possible, right?
Yeah. Well, you just opened the door there for a possible long-term conversation about government intervention versus using private markets, which we will not get into. But, hey, let me jump back to one thing that was in the story that I thought that I never thought about, never heard, but and I don't think will happen with beef, but it said, demand destruction describes what happens when prices stay high long enough to buyers permanently change their behavior, and that they don't, even when the prices come back down. I mean, is that something you could even see happening with beef that people?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Once you change people's patterns, it's sometimes really tricky to change their patterns back.
I know, but we're talking beef, man.
Yeah, I know, but people. Hey, look at all these younger people that have switched to become vegans, or
I guess.
Know what that is. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's tough sometimes to switch those people back. And that's all. You know, once you've broken their habits and they flip-flop, they may not come back to it. And I can see that.
No, they're younger, sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's dive back into the corn and beans where you want to pick up where you want to.
Well, I mean, we can talk beans. Beans are about what the report, somewhat bullish, so slightly lowered old crop ending stocks. To 340, and you're starting new crop ending stocks at 310. So, you know, I think it was a win for the bulls for sure. There's some arbitrary or I don't know, maybe some stretches on some of the new crop. You know, you got exports. They raised exports 100 million bushels. Well, shit, I don't know. I guess we don't know what comes to the Trump Xi thing. You know, I don't know how China plays their cards. They say one thing one minute, and then, you know, month or two later, or a couple weeks later, we could be doing something different. So, you know, the demand numbers to me on the USDA new crop balance sheet are very arbitrary, and just you don't know. They left the acres, Todd, unchanged from the market.
That was
planning.
Why? Yeah. Why? Yeah. Okay. That's got to change, right? That's definitely changed here down the road, right?
Hell, I don't know. I was wrong.
That's true. We were wrong last year. That's true.
Yeah, I kept thinking those numbers were going to be lower. Hell, they kept going higher. So I was thinking that the bean acre number was going to be up closer to 86 million acres. Right. They left it at 84.7. So you got to believe the bean acre number is probably going to go higher. But I'm not sure of that. The only reason I say that, everybody's of the mindset, because of the higher input cost, farmers just went out there and ran the beans in, put more beans in versus corn. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, we talked to Joe Sinclair up there in Iowa last week. I've talked to all kinds of people. I mean, there's a lot of producers that said, well, I was planning on planting a few more beans, but hell, with these corn prices rallied up there, I ran some corn on in there.
Yeah.
So You see what I'm saying? I don't really know what the hell is going to happen here in these acre numbers. I would want to argue that the bean acre numbers are going to go higher. But at the same time, the USDA is starting out the bean average yield at 53 bushels an acre. Well, hell, that's what we harvested last year, and that was the all-time new record. So, you know, if you want to use some common sense, you could probably sit here and say, well, you could take the bean acre number higher. But in the same breath, why not start the average yield forecast at maybe, say, 50, 51,
right,
and, you know, somewhere in that area. So, you know, I could add some acres, but I could take some off yield. So net-net, probably not much change on the production side of the balance
sheet
for me looking forward. And then I said on the demand side, it's kind of a big wild card guess because you got all the new crush capacity. You got them, you got the USDA bumping that crush, domestic crush number, you know, quite a bit higher by a significant amount. And at the same time, bumping the export higher. And I just don't know. I mean, we don't know. We're just going to have to wait and see how things play out. With that being said, I think that does help provide a little bit more support in the bean market, though. So I don't think there's the downside risk in the bean market that there may have been prior to probably this report. I think there was some fear that, you know, this Trump-Xi meeting doesn't really play out as some had thought, maybe the bulls had thought, and you could quickly come over here and trim a buck 50 off beans. I don't think that's the case any longer. I think if the meeting doesn't go well, yes, you're going to have a knee-jerk reaction lower. But I don't think it's going to take it to aggressively lower. I think there's still, you know, some downward protection in there just from the recent balance sheet moves, the price of inputs, the overall good global demand for the renewable and where the government put the RVO. So, you know, I think net-net, the bigger breaks, you know, I don't think they're going to be as significant as I thought they could have been before this. So we're going to wait. We're going to be on pause here. I already have about 40% of 2026 production price. We just threw one line in on the 2027 production, made a small sale early. Those prices are better than where we made the sale. So I'm just going to be patient here for a moment. See if Trump can't pull a rabbit out of the hat and get China to agree to buy a bigger quantity of beans than they already have, either for new crop. I've personally given up hope mostly for old crop, but if he can pull something out of the hat, hey, more power to him. And I'd love to see it, and I'd love to pull his prices higher. I do, Todd, still have those damn puts on that I'd put on almost 2 months ago. Luckily, remember, I took profits on about three quarters.
Right.
But I held these remaining puts, and I've given all that money back that I had made on those puts. And I'll probably end up scratching that. I'm holding a bunch of, not a bunch, but I still have quite a few 1150 July puts. You know, they may expire worthless. I don't know. I'm just going to hold them. Like I said, I have the trade paid for. So I'm just kind of holding them now, just out of spite. If I was down, I'd have probably trim my losses. So, you know, that's where I'm at the bean side of things. We're just going to kind of play it out and see how it goes. Corn, there really wasn't much any surprises to me in the corn market. You know, they bumped old crop ending stocks slightly higher. And we got new crop ending stocks coming in at, what, 1.957 billion bushels, which is just a touch below 2 billion. So, you know, there were some folks, the bulls were hoping they'd see new crop ending stocks sub 1.8 billion bushels. That obviously didn't happen. We're still at this 1.95. But again, that question is, Todd, what the hell are we going to do with acres? The USDA left the planted acre number unchanged for March at 95.3 million. You know, there's some folks talking that number could be closer to 94 million. Well, all of a sudden now you got a 94 million acre crop, and they're starting out using a 183 yield. So let's say you went 94 million planted acres and the yield was closer to 180. Well, hell, you're taking a nice chunk off production. Now you are going to get that ending stock number down sub 1.8. And, you know, we've got potential for some good upside momentum. And, you know, I think we're in a position here with the sales currently on the books, still some weather risk remaining, the Trump meeting coming up. There's been some chatter that China may be interested in buying some U.S. corn or maybe some ethanol or something of that nature. I think you want to just, like I said, I like pausing here ahead of it. if you hadn't made sales or you don't have any 2027 sales on when we're up here north of $5, might be a place to nibble on a little bit and feather some in. I don't have any spec positions on. You know, we're sitting there basically doing nothing. I told you about the long Deese 27 corn versus the short hard red runner Deese. And, you know, that was the way I picked to play that wheat market. You know, it is what it is. And I'm going to be a long-term player. And I think eventually, like I said, I think things will come back around. It could be painful for an extended period of time. But I think when we get closer to 27, I think you'll see some things change or shake out. But, you know, that's really it, Todd, on the corn front. Like I said, I think we're going to see a lot more you know, when we get into next week, I think we have the ratings and conditions coming out, crop conditions from the USDA. It's in next week or the week after. But we'll start seeing, you know, getting better gauge of where things may be yield-wise, what's happening out in the field a little bit better. I'm not seeing any real problematic here. I mean, we're still running slightly ahead of schedule on the planting. Most of the places I'm hearing, you know, there's pockets of problems like always, but overall, nothing too crazy that would make me worried that there's any major weather story. As long as the drought is west, Todd, I think the west and southwest, you know, or your area down in that, I think the market's going to not be overly concerned.
Agreed.
You know, hell, the drought's been entrenched in those areas for quite some time off and on. But, you know, if that drought were to move more into the Midwest or move more to the east, obviously there would be some concern issues. So, you know, I think overall, net, I'm just sitting here kind of patiently waiting. I think there could be some more upside momentum in corn if it gets pulled a little bit higher from this meeting in China and some of those things. So we'll just have to see from there. So you okay to fall out of your chair over there? There's a lot of noise in there.
No, I had to. I was sitting by a window and I had to adjust it. Sorry. It's good to know it makes noise. I won't make sure I don't do that in the future. Hey, so in regard to the emergence things and stuff like that, then there really isn't an issue then with potentially with pollination, because from an emergence standpoint, I mean, everything's up together. You told me once that, you know, if it gets spread out over a long period of time, so at least headed into whatever the weather could be, pollination is at least still set to be decent, I guess, if the weather's decent. Does that make sense? Does that not make sense?
Obviously, if the weather's, I don't think problems with planting. No, I don't think you're having. You're basically, if we were to plant all the crop all at once, you know, then you start getting into that. And that's what happens some of these years where you have delay in planting, and then everyone goes at once. Now you're going to have more risk in that 1 or 2 weeks than you'd normally typically have for pollination. That's not the case this year. I mean, yes, you had Iowa have that big week last week where they got caught up. So you'll have a lot of, you know, a big chunk, 20-30% of their wheat pollinating in that 1 week. But net overall, we've stayed ahead of planting pace overall for the United States from wire to wire here. And so, you know, I think we're fine. I think, you know, pollination dates will roll out mostly as anticipated or historically on their averages. And so we just got to watch the weather. You know, if things turn crazy hot and the spigots turn off, I mean, yeah, there's going to be some weather risk premium added as we move closer to pollination. If forecasts remain somewhat subdued and a few showers here and there and nothing crazy, you know, just no 2-3 week 100 plus temps all in one pop, I think we probably just cruise through here pollination part and into July, and then people start focus more on the harvest weather. But I'm just not seeing anything in the forecast right now that has me crazily thinking there's a big full weather market coming. But
I would agree. I think we're definitely setting up.
There are a lot of people, the Bulls, wanting to play that Super El Nino.
No.
Happening. Yeah, there are a lot of people wanting to
play. I know.
That.
I'm just saying. I'm saying no. It ain't happening. If you're talking about happening this season.
Well, I mean, it might not be happening and impacting or having any great impact here in the U.S. But you're seeing some people put that arrow in their quiver as far as South American production next year. And with this, Todd, meaning higher input costs. A lot higher input costs. They don't have the subsidy programs like we have here in the United States or the safety nets like we have. So if you're a producer in South America and you're looking at dramatically higher input costs and you then have the media over here going nutso about Super El Nino, well, shit, you might not want to put a lot of money at risk in inputs and planting more acres if you're worried you're going to come into some major weather hiccups. You see what I'm saying? So,
yep. Absolutely.
It's interesting, right? I mean, and the funds buy into that rhetoric and some of that story. And so you may not see near as many acre expansion, and you're already hearing that. Argentina isn't going to roll out maybe as many acres. You're hearing that, you know, maybe Brazil's not going to roll out as many new acres. You're going to see maybe some producers maybe pull back a little bit. So it's interesting to me that the way the headlines are playing out, you have a weather worry that's out there on the horizon quite a ways, and you have these higher input costs. So there's kind of a double whammy that you could at least you could make that story believable from a bullish perspective, that you could have a lot more producers pulling back global acres. So, you know, that's something shit we got to pay attention to. That's why I'm saying I just pause here a minute and see if these funds get more bulled up. And it just, I'm telling you now, I'm more scared of the upside than I'm downside in any of these markets anymore, because the downside shit, it's zero, right? You can only go to zero. But you look at some of these markets, like look what gold's done, look what silver's done, look at copper. I mean, just go look at some of these markets and how crazy they have ran at times. And, you know, and you sit there and you're like, wow, I mean, there's potential to plow crazy money into the long side. You can go, hell, you know, you could be talking $10 coins. Want to get crazy, yeah. Want to get nuts the way they've plowed into some other markets. So I don't know. That's why I said I think you just pause here a second. Get your sales caught up to where you know you're not going to have any losers on your hands. That's what I'm saying. You get 40-50% price close above $5. I mean, it's pretty hard to wreck the wagon. I mean, you know what I'm saying. So I think that's your goal. You get in that 30-50% price range. You got your insurance. You got some profitability locked in. You know, it's pretty hard to turn that into a loser. Now, if you're the guy that's sitting there and he ain't going to price nothing, it could turn into a loser on you. I mean, you don't know how things are going to play out or turn. And then the next thing, you're looking at that little debacle. So, you know, for me, I'm not that much of a gambler. I look at it more as a business than a speculator when it comes to marketing the bushels. So, like I said, I look at it more as I'm a car dealer is what I've always looked at it as, Todd. And just meaning I'm a car dealership. I own a Dodge dealership, Ford, GM, whoever your favorite one is. Hell, have a John Deere dealership where you want a Case, whatever. Okay, so you own a dealership. Well, you'll get X allocation of 2026 models in this year, and you need to get them sold, and you're going to get an allocation of 2027 in. And so, you know, are you going to sell a few 2027s early to some guys that are willing to pay full sticker or plus a little premium? I don't know. Are you? I would if I owned the dealership, because, shit, I know I got a lot of 26 still to move, and I need to move some of that inventory. So I just think of it like that. Rather than it's a rare picture or a rare antique that I'm not ever going to get replaced again. You see what I'm saying? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, there's different ways of pricing things. If it's a one-off item and you're never going to replace it again and you love it, okay, well, you're going to hold out for the highest possible price and you ain't budget on it. But, you know, you're getting new inventory every year. Hell, you know, it ain't hurting to sell some guys some letting them book some early sales.
No, and I think a lot of people lose sight of that. Let me ask you: you touched on the upside, potential upside. Do you believe in the commodity or the ag super cycle stuff that I see floating around on the internet? They're all calling for some strong upside, and a lot of the commodities, ag included. Is that anything in your world?
Well, you know, ever since I've been trading, you know, every year someone's calling for a commodity super cycle.
I suppose.
You know what I'm saying, and I mean I've heard it so many times throughout my career. I'm saying it isn't, but hell, it already feels like it has been, right? I mean, look at what's happened in some of these. I mean, look at since COVID, you look at lumber prices. Go look, like I said, copper prices, coffee prices, orange juice prices, egg prices, cattle prices, gold prices, stock, oil prices. I could go through the whole list. I mean, what hasn't gone to all-time highs since COVID, you know, in the last 5 years. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we're already in a damn super cycle to some degree. Yeah, we've had some pullbacks, obviously. But look where wheat and corn went during in the last 5 years. I mean, again, it's all about time. What type of time are you talking about on this super cycle? Shit, I feel like I've been in a super cycle. So
right.
I don't know. I struggle to necessarily, I don't know. I question if it's just going to be some crazy green light, full speed racing ahead on these global economies. You have to have that, right, to have a full-blown commodity super cycle, because you're going to have demand for commodities like crazy. I just struggle to get there because I know you, and I know I can get you on this kick. With all the financial global debt, holy smokes, dude, it's just hard for me to imagine that we're going to see just some crazy global growth all of a sudden just take off. I don't know. I believe at some point that has to become like an 800-pound, piece of steel tied around your leg here, handcuffed to your ankle from a global economic standpoint. I that's where I'm saying. I can see the 3-4% growth or things of that nature, and we're trickling along, we're continuing to trickle along while debt's continuing to climb at a quicker pace than that. But man, when you start talking some explosive growth or just crazy strong, I struggle to get there with this debt like it is, Todd, and inflation where it is, right?
No, definitely 100% on that one. I just last thing before we move on to some bigger macro stuff, I meant to ask you. Today, later on, they're going to be, if I'm correct, the House is going to vote on E-15 legislation, try to move it on to the Senate. You got any insight on that that you need to share, or just wait and see what happens?
I was talking to Willis earlier on the phone, and he was in Washington. He said, shit, he's trying to corral another 11, 12 votes or something to get it passed. But, I can't imagine. It's just baffling to me that it hasn't anyway. It's not a mandate. It's just to allow it to be possible. If you want to sell E-15, you can sell it. If you don't, so I can't get my head there. Anyway, I think it should have been passed a long, long time ago. I always argue that E85 is what really killed the ethanol industry, it's been somewhat difficult through the years to recover from that a little bit when you're starting to talk with Washington legislation. I mean, we came out too aggressive, the E85, and it allowed people to create some crazy, dig their heels in and create some crazy arguments against ethanol. And they've been able to hang on to some of those headlines and some of that rhetoric for way, way too long. And yeah, it has to change. I mean, E15 has to go into place. I think, like you're saying, what are you saying? E30 talked about in Brazil. Even higher in some other places. So, I think you're seeing people start to bump those numbers higher. Like I said, I think the E5 did us more damage than good early on, and we still haven't overcome some of that craziness and talk that is still important. Yeah.
Well, let's see if I can fold some of the stuff, macro stuff, into one big question or just lay a couple things out and let you roll with it. But, I mean, obviously, we're seeing some reports on global oil inventories, obviously, where the price is and stuff. Just want to get your feel on that. The surge in the inflation CPI came out yesterday. And obviously, the Fed's, from what I'm seeing, you tell us your opinion, there's not going to be a cut in 2026 or you're below 25%. So just lay out the landscape as you see with these moving pieces, because obviously we're back to, I mean, this war was supposed to be ended a few weeks back, or a month or so back. So give us the lay of the land.
I never use the word never. I mean, you said we're not going to see any cuts in 2026. I don't know about that.
I know. I know you think that way.
I'm with you. I've been saying, though, for several months, when everyone was saying we were going to see two or three cuts, I was saying we're probably not going to see any. And when everyone was saying we're going to see some rate hikes, I was still saying we're probably not going to see any. I'm of the camp, probably no change in rates for 2026. I've been in that camp for quite some time, just simply because I think you have this yin-yang pull. You've got the pull of higher inflation, which any way you want to slice the numbers, real inflation, at least to the consumer, has been higher. And on the flip side, I think you have some embedded worry about AI and what type of damage it can do to the overall employment situation. So net-net, I think those two are keeping the Fed kind of in check here, meaning kind of tying the Fed's hands, not allowing it to do much of anything, which is fine. I'm not opposed to that. I know we want rates lower because we've got such massive government debt, and obviously that helps cut some of that from the budget, some of that massive interest payments. And at the same time, obviously lower interest rates would also go a long ways to help in the U.S. housing industry, which, you know, I can't remember what the number is, but it's like $1 out of every 4 or 5 in the economy is tied to housing some way, shape, or form, whether it's remodeling or new refrigerators or, you know, washers and dryers, whatever it may be, it's tied to the housing sector. And so, you know, yeah, I think a reduction in rates probably is where I would be leaning personally, just because I think it could help fuel the economy. I don't believe it would spark higher inflation necessarily just because of the slight rate reductions. I don't think that's the case. I think the reason for inflation isn't that you have – there's two types of inflation. So you have inflation that can be caused and created by too much money and too many people chasing too little of a supply, right? So if you're getting aggressive wage growth with our employers, you know, if we're seeing sizable wage growth, that's giving more people expendable money to go out there and chase more items and push prices higher. I don't see that being the case at all whatsoever. I think you just have inflation higher because you got supply out of position. You've got, like COVID, you have supply out of position. Now, COVID could be a little double-pronged because the government put so much money in play, right? They printed so much money and pushed it out there into the economy to keep people spending. You could argue that you did have forced inflation from more money in play. What I'm saying right now is I think your inflation, the only reason you have inflation at the moment is because you have supply out of position. And I think you're seeing lower wage growth. I think we saw that in the last couple employment reports. And I think people are spending more on energy and they're spending more on food. So I don't see how they're going to have more available money to go chase other things and push inflation higher. That's what I'm saying. I don't think that's the case. I think inflation is actually going to be not the problem. I think the problem, if you move further along, is going to be deflation, just simply because of what the new technology is going to do on the pricing models of things. So, you know, I think if you're the Fed, you're just going to stay put here. You stay pat. You're going to have some people that are worried on the Fed board that are worried about inflation. I'm not in that camp. And then you're going to have some folks that are worried about the employment situation. I see myself more in that camp. And that's where I would be more preempted to cut than I would to hike in our current space or our current environment. That doesn't mean what the hell the Fed's going to do. Like, right? I mean, no one cares what my opinion is. They want to know what the Fed's going to do. And like I said, I think you're going to see the vote split. You got the new Fed guy coming in, Warsh. And if he comes right out of the gates and cuts, you're going to have every media source in the world saying that, oh, he's Trump's puppet and all this. So I doubt he comes in and wants to cut. In fact, almost every Fed chair that's come in, I think the last 4 or 5, have actually raised rate. Their first move was a slight increase. And maybe that's just because they don't want to appear to be too dovish, or they don't want to appear to be, whatever it may be. So I don't know. I could see, you know, the odds makers maybe giving just a slight favor to a hike than a cut. But again, like you're saying, most people, I think, seem to be in that no-cut camp at this moment, and that's probably where we're at. If rates go higher, I mean, it'll knock shit out of the stock market, in my opinion. I think you'll see the stock market take a pretty sizable step back because you'll have valuation, and the bulls caught off sides quite a bit.
Let me ask you that, because we're going to jump into some investing, and forgive me if I'm crossing over back into macro, but got two things I want to bring up. I mean, we're sitting here and looking at all-time highs while amidst all the oil price shocks, inflation, geopolitical uncertainties, all right? I mean, we got all that going on, and we're still hitting all-time highs. So explain to me why you feel that once we get past Q1, earnings season, especially in the video, that bulls are going to go on pause.
You're saying that we shouldn't be at all-time highs in the stock market because of what? Inflation? What? Because of
so we got the oil price issues, there's inflation, geopolitical uncertainties, all that stuff going on.
The whole question is oil, the price at the pump, has it slowed consumer spending anywhere? No, so far, no. I mean, so far, all the data says no. And I don't think prices at the pump are probably high enough as of yet to probably cause that much of an impact. Obviously reduced our reliance on gasoline to some degree as a nation, as far as meaning how it, as a percentage of our overall budget from a U.S. consumer perspective, that we just don't, it's not as big of a percentage as it was in the past. Now, that's twofold. People aren't driving maybe as far to work. They're using more of a hybrids vehicles. They're using some all-electric EV vehicles. And a lot of the cars on the road have gotten way more fuel efficient and just way more efficient in general. So, you know, so I don't know if you're slowed consumer spending a whole lot right here with the prices where they're at. I know all my buddies that are driving big diesel trucks like myself. Yeah, I'm sitting there like, holy smokes. You know, it's definitely higher price, but we're not seeing that in the data that's the Q1 earnings reports or anything like that. In fact, you've seen just the opposite. You've seen Disney report, you know, they're still running strong. You're seeing a lot of these other places saying they're still seeing big increases and running strong. So, you know, I don't see that from that perspective, Todd. And then what was your other one? You said so you had higher interest.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to throw in all the uncertainties, all the pains for the consumers because, you know, right before earnings season, we were talking about how, you know, earnings season is going to be a distraction, you know, for the war stuff and stuff. But we were reaching all-time highs right before that, too. I guess, Kevin, I'm just trying to.
Yeah, but you got all-time highs in earnings. I mean, the earnings growth was off the chain. You were up 20%.
It was off the chain, but I'm saying we were still. I guess what I'm trying to get squared in my head is because and it was brought on by the comment that we made today that, you know, after the Q1 season earnings, that the bulls are probably going to pause and see what goes on with the Middle East. Prior to earnings season, we said, hey,
well,
man.
What's pause mean? Just maybe sit here and kind of look around a minute and then just go another way higher? I mean, that probably. I mean, I don't know if we're going to pull back anything crazy. I don't know. I mean, it seems.
All right. So
with earnings based on where earnings were, why would you be a big seller?
These are great questions, man. I'm just trying to figure out putting pieces together and reading that don't make sense.
And I know everybody and their brother wants to say we're in the same position we were in 1999. Here we are, .com bubble all over again, blah, 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 right? I'll tell you right now, if the Fed hikes and they follow it up with another hike, yeah, I could see a repeat of the .com bubble. Because that's kind of what triggered the last whole debacle. I just can't see the Fed hiking, but maybe.
The other thing, I
got one hike, but if they fought with another hike, yeah, you're definitely going to see a massive.
Yeah.
I think you're too big.
The other point was sent you a tweet that and I just never thought, and you and I even haven't talked about this yet, so this will be the first time. But it was like, man, could we be actually progressing? It's in regard to how things are going on. You know, is it our bubble? Could we be progressing faster than humans have ever seen? Meaning that this, you know, we're nowhere near overvalued or bubble status because we're just in a new realm. Thoughts?
Well, I don't think anything's new. I mean, I think it's a different realm. I don't know if it's a new realm. I mean, I think it's different. Meaning, you're seeing companies become way more efficient and way more produce way better gross profit margins. I mean, the leaders, you know, back then were Exxon and you had Microsoft, but nobody was hammering the gross profit margins that these people are hammering in. And with these chips and some of these software plays and some of the other technology companies that are now becoming bigger percentages of the indexes. I mean, the gross profit margin in these places are off. They're crazy. So I think you got a lot higher and stronger gross profit margins coupled with a lot more people investing or able to invest, coupled with a lot fewer investments in the stock market to chase, meaning there's a lot fewer number of listed companies. And even then, with the ability to trade anywhere and everywhere where you're at, if for the just average everyday mom-and-pop investor, and having the resources and the research at their fingertips, I think you are seeing more stocks, a fewer number that concentrated investments are going into. And with that being the case, again, the upside is the scary part. You know, tulip mania all over you. I mean, if you got everybody in the everybody out there trying to take their money and buy a select number of tulips, it's like, holy shit. I mean, prices could continue to just go beyond your wildest dreams. And I think that could happen. I don't think we're there yet. I mean, someone held my head and said, if you could tell me where we're at, and we wanted to compare it to the 99,000 combo, I'd say you're 95, 96. I mean, maybe you're 96. You know, maybe
you went back. If you went back to then, if you go back to that time as an investor trader, knowing what you know now, because right now you're taking profits off on the rallies and such like that. Would you tell yourself the same thing back then? Or would you be more aggressive?
But the problem I'm having is, I felt like back then it was just more crazy euphoria, like everybody was going nuts and everybody was, you know, borrowing money like crazy and using that money to invest in the market. And that's probably more 98, 99, right? And everybody's just going nuts. But I don't know. I was young then, and I was running around with people and traders and investors that were acting like that. You see what I'm saying? So don't know if that's how that time period played out for me, because I was young. I'm 25, 26 years old. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, I was young and I was running around with young people, and they were all young bulls, and they were willing to bet everything on this rally and all that. And the euphoria was crazy. Well, now I'm running around with a bunch of old bears, a bunch of guys, you know, old folks that were a lot more conservative. We think the young people have lost their mind to some degree, and we think the whole world's going to end because we can't understand. We don't know all this or understand all this newness, and we think it's all just bullshit. So, you know, we're more married. So I don't know if it's my individual perspective is tripping me up, saying this doesn't feel to me like anything like it felt when I was in 96, 7, 98, 99, you know. Or is it just because I am older and more bearish and have been more beaten up? And you see what I'm saying? I don't know. I don't know. So it's a tough dilemma, and I don't want to make any big bold forecast on that. That's why I'm staying invested.
Sure.
I'm using the rallies to trim some positions and free up more cash, and I'm going to continue to do that shit until maybe eventually I'm all in cash and I'm all the way out. But right now I'm sitting at about 38% cash. I've added to my cash stockpile here in the last week or two and trimming more things and just continue to trim. I even trimmed some of the triple Qs the other day on the big rally. And, you know, I think I'm just going to keep trimming a little bit. And any big significant pullbacks, I'll probably add. And, you know, and that's how I'm going to play it out and just see where we end up here. So.
Last investing comment. You got 30 seconds if you even want to make a comment on Bitcoin.
Nah,
where's
I mean,
that? What is it doing?
Long. Like I said, I'm back to full position in it. And I don't know. Hell, where are we going? 100,000? I don't know.
Well,
I mean, I don't think it's just a runaway freight train higher, but do I think it can move higher? Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, I just thought that tweet we ran on it was one of the better pieces on it that I've written. It made you think about that. Maybe there's some structure to this thing that's deeper than it feels like right now. So anyway, no, it was good to see the move. It didn't die over the winter like a lot of people thought it would. So,
that tweet you ran, though. It's come on, it's some guy talking his own position shit. Anybody could
what
do
he
that.
Say? What did he say?
I'm not
what
buying any. I'm not buying anything from anybody that tries to tell me Bitcoin is the new digital gold. Shit, I've heard that forever, and it doesn't act like gold. Doesn't respond like gold. Tell me something different than that. I mean, maybe it's a new current. Maybe it's something different, but it doesn't act like gold. I mean, I'm just telling you. So,
well, Peter,
we've seen it play out. It didn't act like gold, and it isn't having to me. It's not, So anyway, everybody talks their own position. I am long. I am, but I'm bullish for no other reason than it's just the market that's moving, and I jumped on the train and I haven't really jumped off. You know what I mean? I just jump off here and there, and but I couldn't tell you if it'll be around or if it won't be around in 20 years.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to our last area of the day. Yesterday, I ran a story, and I'm going to tie us in that, you know, we're talking AI a lot now. We're using it ourselves and stuff, and we'll probably be talking more about that as we move down the road. But you ran a story yesterday, a historical look at the railroad and how AI might be similar. I just wanted you to maybe share the key points. I've got some questions I can ask you, but it was really, I thought, interesting. And it made you stop and take a look at, you know, once again, for all those naysayers that say, you know, this time is different. Maybe it's not.
Yeah. And that story on Monday, for anybody that wants to go back and check it out or look that hadn't seen it, I kind of went into a deep dive on it. I ended up down a damn rabbit hole, and I was just wanting to think back on how industries, more for my own investment purposes into startup companies or people that are calling me wanting money for different ideas. I just wanted to try and get a better understanding of how things played out with the railroads when they came and how dramatic of a change it brought about, and then just try and compare that to what we're seeing happen and play out in AI. And, you know, I think it's interesting as hell. And I think it's one of those articles you need to keep reference back.
For sure.
A lot. And, you know, it made a lot of sense to me. The more I've talked to producers and the more I've talked to people in agriculture and investors and Wall Street people and looking back on how I've lost so much money, I'm not lying, investing in ag tech startups or some of these things that I thought looked like they were going to be great, but they ended up just, you know, shit, I lost a ton of money on them. And I think it's similar to this. And I look at these railroads and I think to myself, what's the biggest Achilles heel in production agriculture? And I think Joe made a great point and really made me stop. And I spent a lot of time that week thinking about it. It's time. It's do we have time? Because everything has to be so timely. Planting the crop has to be timely based on when it's raining, when it's not raining, what's this, what's happening here with the soil, what's temperature, is the soil temp hot enough, is it cold, you know, where are we at? So things have to happen in a timely fashion, and they have to have, same with spraying, same with harvesting, some else. But there's one ingredient to that. You all right, Todd? Did you fall down again?
I'm good, man.
All right, there's one ingredient to all of that. It's time, and can you have enough? Where do you find the people to help? Okay, so if you come out with something and it isn't going to be a big time saver, the adoption rate, a huge time saver, the adoption rate is not very good. And that's what Joe pointed out with, say, See and Spray technology. Yes, it's going to save you quite a bit of money, but it isn't going to save you a lot of time. And if you're up against the clock, you're just going to have a plane come in and spray the field. I mean, now if you've got the people and the manpower to have a guy sit in and ride around the tractor and use the See and Spray technology, yes, you're going to save some money. But when it comes to saving time and doing things in a more timely manner, that's where I think a lot of these have fallen flat. And that's where I've made mistakes in investing in a lot of things because they just didn't do that. And it's regenerative ag. It could be, it's great in theory, but in practicality, you got to have the manpower and the people to pull a lot of that off at scale. And so I look at the railroads and I say, what in the hell happened to these railroads? So in the beginning of the railroad period, the tracks and the infrastructure wasn't laid very far. So say for me, there were some tracks laid from Kansas City to Columbia, Missouri. Well, how'd it take you? You know, 2 hours to drive there by car. It's not very far. It's just, and it is probably a lot easier for people to just hook up the buggy and drive the horse and the wagon there than it was to travel to Kansas City, find a place to get the train ticket, get on the train, take the train, deal with all that. So they're probably, you know, that's why there wasn't a lot of early adoption. It didn't really save people all that much time. The whole thing of the railroad was it saved people, in the end, it saved people time on traveling and moving items. A ton of time was saved. Until we get there in agriculture or production agriculture, I don't think you're going to see that much adption with AI. Yeah, it's going, people are going to put things there, and they're going to get better decision-making skills and decision-making tools. But nothing's going to matter until these rural areas get connectivity and everything gets connected, like the railroad tracks. All the railroad tracks had to get connected. You couldn't just have them dead-end in here and dead-end in there, and this guy's running an independent line there, and his tracks don't meet the other tracks, and this guy's got an independent line. That's how ag kind of is right now, you know, and until we get that, more like the railroads, once they were finally completed, then you're going to see some massive and crazy change, I think, in agriculture. But hell, Todd, I bet we're, I don't know, some people say we're right there. I'd say we're 20 years, I mean, my opinion. The last 20 years, I thought we'd be way further with some of this than we are. Meaning blockchain in the farm or any of the things you and I talked about through the years. It hasn't come to fruition as of yet. And I don't know if it's going to come to fruition in the next 5 years either. I'd say more like 20 is my thought. And maybe in 20, you're going to see way more of the robotics take place out in the field. And you're going to see the major infrastructure change. I thought it was interesting when you look back at the railroads, how much was changed. So it's just like even a hat maker, say like Stetson, once the railroads became available, Stetson was able to put their hats on rails and run them all over the United States. And hell, you put hat maker, there was a hat maker in every town making cowboy hats and other hats, and hell, they were put out of business. And that's where you've seen Sears come in, you know, and they used that rail to their advantage, and Montgomery Wards and Sears and the different players that really made their play with the infrastructure that was built around that. So, you know, and in the same breath, what went out? You know, what really went out? And that's what I think we have to look at here with the AI. I almost feel like with the AI, we may pivot back away from the big box stores and the big hyperscalers that we saw on the retail side of things, and back to maybe the more localized mom and pops where we're trying to head. And I think AI could allow those local mom and pops to become a lot more astute, a lot better at decision-making, and be able to compete a lot better. And maybe we make that pivot back that direction. On the farm, I don't really know. I've always said I thought we were going to go and separate out to people doing more industrial agriculture, meaning creating crops and growing crops in a more industrial, like out in the areas you're at, Todd, and growing those for industrial purposes, whatever that may be, whether it's the biofuels or the renewables or plastics or whatever they may come up with next for crops to be made into. And then you're going to have more of the specialty type players that are in closer to your urban areas, and they're going to be growing more direct for the retailer or the person, you know, the end user that's using them for restaurant use or looking to sell it in grocery stores or things like that. And you know, going into plays along that space. And so, you know, I think that's probably what still ends up happening. But I just worry about the uptake in the ag startup world. You know, you sure in the shit don't want to be investing in software companies right now, just from my perspective with the way AI is coming on. You don't really want to be investing in some of these others that have a lot of government policy tied to it, because, hell, you don't know how that's going to shift and change as we ebb and flow with the policy changes. So, you know, there's some extra additional layers of risk in agriculture, from my perspective, that you may not have in some of the tech space. So be sitting there and thinking, boy, I'm watching all these guys make a ton of money in these tech startups, and, boy, I bet that could be the way in the ag. It's a lot more difficult game, in my opinion. It's become a lot more difficult. And I think that's going to be the case, as it'll lag in getting the infrastructure built, Todd, versus the other industries. You see what I'm saying? Just, I don't think we'll get the tracks laid in agriculture. And we're all open to adopting new technology. I just don't think we'll get the tracks laid in agriculture like you may have already have laid in biotech or, you know, some of that producing the military type. You know, those are small niche industries, and like, hell, they've laid the tracks and they've done it right. we're having connectivity problems. We can't even get, still out in some of these rural areas where agriculture is heavy. We just can't get the connectivity to use the AI. So, that's where our friends at Emergent, they're trying to make that play happen. And there's some other companies out there that I like that are trying to make that play. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see who comes out on top and who can get the one platform or get the two or three platforms that, like the railroad runs on and get those tracks in place. So what are your thoughts?
No, that's it. I love the analogy and how you laid it out and stuff. And it makes me always go back to the things in my 10 years in ag, and I was new to ag, but the things you wrote about, you mentioned blockchain. So I'm thinking of companies out there, and I don't want to mention names, but I mean, there was crops out there that were going to be used, the industrial crops, you said, that I was so behind. And they're still in business, but they're not doing anything. They're not commercialized as to the extent I thought they would be. And we're looking at some of these other topics. So it will be, and I think you're right. You look at back when they were writing about, when they're doing sci-fi and writing about things and doing George Jetson and all that stuff, then how long it took to get there. I mean, obviously we're going to get much faster with people thinking like Elon Musk and stuff and the technology there to help them make faster. So you're probably right, though. And I know we've been having some conversations about investing in ag and stuff, and I think we're going to write maybe a story in the near time about the ways to look at it. Because, I mean, dude, you've been doing ag tech for 10 years, and gosh darn it, I mean, if you'd have known what you know now, you wouldn't have gotten an ag, or you'd have viewed it a whole lot different. So it's been quite a learning experience the last 10 years with all that money and the government policies and stuff. So a lot of changes, but the other day.
And more like 20-plus years of doing it and getting nowhere. So,
yeah.
I mean.
Well, yeah, I only go back 10.
I mean, so. I've invested in ag tech since, I've been 25 years, somewhere in there, or more. But not that's what I'm saying, with nothing really to show for it. I mean, net, loser.
It's crazy, isn't it?
I've had a crazy year there, but net, no. Net, I'm down for sure. So
and you've like done said, better. You've done better as a commodity trader than you've done as an ag tech investor.
There's not even any question of that. And then
right. I mean, like
what pisses me off more than anything is that I sit and I tell my wife, my kid, I'm like, how much money I've thrown at various ag tech throughout the years. If I would have just taken that same amount of money and just put it at John Deere, ADM, Anderson's,
right,
Bunge, I go through the list. It's like, shit, I'd have been way better. I mean, it's not even a comparison. But I think what I did, where I messed up is, and if I look back at my life, I really listened to a lot of people like the Kauffman Foundation, and listened to some other people that, you talk about you need to have X amount of your portfolio invested in early entrepreneurial startup type thing, this, that, and here. And I thought I was maybe going to outfox some people and be like, I know more in the ag space, so why don't I just focus more of my attention on putting it into ag startups rather than – I'm not going to lie to you. I did several bio startups early when I was a lot younger, and then I had to put in a clause, I guess, in my own investment strategy, or I never invest in any biotech startups again because I'm not lying. I think I went on a streak there where I had thrown money. Well, I was in my 20s or 30s, probably. Michelle would send the check, but I sent money probably 20 or 15 or 20 different biotech startups, and almost every person that came to me, I wanted to throw money at it because I was just a person, and I still am a person that I love buying a story. Like if you got a great story, I'm interested, whether it's history or this, that, if. And in the bio startup space, Todd. Who doesn't love a story trying to save a kid or save a dog?
Exactly.
And they all had great stories, and they were all trying to do just amazing things. And so in your heart, you wanted to be like, man, I wanted my money to be a part of something great like this. And so, shit, I'd always find myself being, that's a great idea. I love that story. I love that. And so I'd throw them money. Well, I just got to the point where I'm like, hey, okay, I can't do that anymore. I'm better off to just give my money to St. Jude or give my money to charities. And I do that. And so I swore I never invested in one more bio startup. So then I thought, well, hell, what are you doing, dummy? Just just focus more on the ag startups, and that way you have a better perspective. You know this industry. You understand things. You know people. You got a good role in it. So just focus on the ag startups. Yeah, well, that was dummy me number two. And, you know, it didn't equate, meaning this. The uptake isn't the same, and I've argued this with a lot of people, and I have friends that taught me a lot of it. I mean, I'm sitting there saying in my head, okay, I'm seeing Peter Thiel and all these guys just killing it over on the tech startup side. Well, I could be that guy in the ag startup side. It's such a different environment, different space. It's not even close, because the big incumbent ag players, they aren't buying these startups anywhere like your big incumbent tech. So you see, every day you write, Todd, and you send me stuff, and I put it in. Google buys some company, Tesla buying some, SpaceX buying some company. They all, right? Meta buys some company. Amazon's buying this. I mean, shit, they're buying so many different companies. You don't see that in the ag space. You don't see John Deere just out there buying companies right and left. You don't see ADM buying companies right and left. You don't see Cargill's buying companies. Yes, they will. They have some. They do some. But nothing like in these broader bio spaces or the tech world space. And so I made that's a critical mistake in my perspective. I played my hand wrong. And I'm not doing that moving forward. I am invested in some. I've just tapered it back. I've just tapered it way back on my ag investments moving forward. I've thrown a little money at some things these last couple months, but, you know, just wanting to make sure the right person, they absolutely have an exit strategy in mind. They've got, you know, we're already started kind of pursuing exit strategies before I even throw my money at them. So I'm telling you, I just think it's a bird of a different color, and you better know a lot. You better have a lot better plan and attack than I had, and that's all I, you know, really. I just heed my warning, because it isn't going to be nearly as easy. You also have what a great moat the incumbents in ag have built for themselves. But getting through the farm gate for a lot of these ag startups, if the big companies aren't going to buy them up and take them inside their moat, it's a hell of a bitch for a lot of these new companies to get through the farm gate. And understandably so, right? Because the sales models and business relationships that have been built through the years and the way these ag companies have built that business. And I think I tip my hat to the ag companies and the big ag companies. I think they've done a phenomenal job. But all I'm telling you is, it makes it difficult as an early stage investor or an early startup in ag to get a lot of penetration and to continue to get that penetration. I still argue, Todd, that there are about 10% of producers who are early adopters of anything, and they love trying new things. But hear what I'm saying here. They love trying new things. So once these new companies come out, they'll get that first 10% and, you know, they'll get those players and those producers to try their product. But then they really start to struggle, a lot of these ag companies, new startup companies, because they can't get beyond that. And then that first 10% they got, those people, what did I tell you they like to do? Try new things. So just because they find something that kind of works a little bit, that doesn't mean they're going to stick with it. Hell, they'll just keep trying new things because they like to try new things. So it's hard to gain market share for a lot of these ag startups once they get that first wave of people that are willing to try things and like to be first through the door. They get those, but then from there forward, it gets very difficult. And a lot of times I'm seeing these companies jump to heavier users where their margins get crushed. They got major margin compression. And as I talked about in the tech world, we're seeing major margin expansion. Remember earlier I talked about the profitability of these tech companies. Crazy. But these ag startups, they'll end up hitting margin compression. It'll crush them. But that's the only way they can get clients and gain any market share. And they think they're going to work back up the channel, the continuum, and it doesn't happen. So I'm just saying it's a lot of dead money. And, you know, I think, you know, Bob Trogel and some of them, and even Tom Wells at times, I asked Tom, I remember one time, probably 10 years ago, and I was a lot younger, I was going to invest in one of the, Oh, it was an ethanol plant up north. I won't name names. I called Tony. He said, let's just wait and be patient. He's like, maybe we can buy them out of bankruptcy in about 3 years, and we'll be buying them for pennies on the dollar. And we did that play at a couple other places. And that's how Bob buys some of these. You know, Bob was the investor that came in and bought Benson there with a group that bought Benson out of bankruptcy. So, like I said, there's a better place to be buying in at a valuation perspective. And maybe that's the play. Maybe I'm not buying in at the right spot. Maybe I'm getting in way too early when it's all, you know, all hype and all show and no go, I guess, so to speak. But and that could be another issue. But I'm not sure. I just think it hasn't worked well for me. I've tried many different approaches to it. I think the biggest learning experience is that I just failed to recognize agriculture is such a bird of a different color when it's compared to the bio or the tech sector, especially when it comes to startups and things of that nature, and adoption and getting through the gate, product market fit, all the things that you need to be super successful at an early stage of business. I failed to underestimate some of the hurdles that would be taking place in agriculture.
No, there's no question. And it always amazed me, Kevin, how much money was thrown at, I guess it's any industry, but by guys like you and stuff. And I'm realizing now that, just because the guys got the money got doesn't mean that they know what they're doing with it. And when people are tugging on your hearts with those good stories, it's tough to do that. But at the end of the day, I'll finish up with what you said about the struggle of startups to get market share beyond the early adopters. I mean, that's why, you had to have the networks. I mean, we look at the Holganics and the Verastems, and I mean, just, man, relationships, acres, and go. And over time, it is just increased and increased. So
there's two success stories you just talked about right there. But come on, man, for those two success stories, shit, we've had 20,000 people. Yeah, that's the problem. And even those success stories, I mean, you know, they shit, those guys worked their asses. I mean, they really had their hustle to make that happen. And you know, that's what I'm saying. It's so fleeting in the sector that it's just really discouraging. And there's lots of great ideas and lots of great businesses that have been started, but it's just, there's more to it than all that. I mean, there's a lot of things that have to line up. A lot of stars have to line up. A lot of things have to happen. And that's what I'm saying. You have different layers of risk involved that there aren't in some of these others. You know, I feel like you have a little more government intervention. You got more things. You know, you just have more weather. You got just everything. There's just a lot more geopolitical. There's just a lot of things and dynamics that can come into play, like the tariffs or China putting them, you know, tariffs on our imports of beans, this, that. And, you know, I mean, all that can play out and impact, you know, a lot of these startups in this ag space. So there is more layers of risk than I saw at the time. Cause I was excited. I wanted to be involved in a lot of these companies. I had great hopes and aspirations. And when you get that way from a mindset, you tend to look through rose colored glasses, and you oftentimes you just miss it. And now that you've been burnt, you sit back and you look back and you're like, ooh, what the hell happened? And it's like, whoa, why didn't I see that? Well, no shit. Why didn't I see it? Because I didn't want to see it, right? I didn't want to see it when I was sending the check. And here I am. So here we are.
Yeah. Good. All good stuff, man. You got anything coming up? I got nothing else. You got anything coming up this next week? Exciting news? Anything we need to be prepared for next week? I know we got Walter next week if the schedules hang on. So that'll be good. Ronan.
Yeah. So we should learn a lot more on that RBO side and renewable side with Walter. That'll be great. You know, we had Mother's Day last weekend. Everything's good with our family. The kids are good.
Cool.
Babies are all moving along good. You know,
All right, brother. Cool. Well, listen, man, appreciate the time as always. And we'll catch up with you next week.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you.
See you.